afternoon.
Good afternoon.
You're joining We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
There we go. And now we've got all our sound situated, of course. Doesn't matter when we get here. If we get here early, we get here late. It always sounds like we got here late. Okay, today we were kind of late. All right, so I hope you guys had a good fourth and enjoyed the programming last week. If you missed it, I do hope you tune in. We had a couple of things. The one that I thought was different and should be kind of interesting because it's stuff you don't hear a lot was Brad Fitch from the Congressional Management Foundation, and he had lots of what's real and what's not going on with Congress. It was fun. Bob, we have our guest on there.
We have Bruce Moran joining us.
Bruce, good morning, good afternoon. What are you? Your afternoon, later afternoon than we are, huh?
Yes, we are.
And we are missing Martin.
Yes.
AKA Marty. I don't know. I never got an email back from him, so I sent him the email or the phone number a couple times. So
okay.
On a break, you may have to leap off and track him down for us because I have no contact information.
Okay.
Not awesome. Maybe you could, I don't know, you want to, well, he's not here. Do you want to talk to us a little bit about President Trump's speech there in Poland, or where do you want to start?
As you know, Paul Teller is a friend of ours, and he had sent us the White House communique on the Polish address. And from what I can tell and what I can see in the news media and how I feel personally is that it was terrific.
It was great.
People were giving him a standing ovation in Poland, and quite a remarkable speech by the First Lady to introduce the president, you know, himself. She was right on. We're looking at a whole new foreign policy initiative, as we saw with the NATO support given during the speech, and as we saw with the, you know, rise of President Trump as being a leader of the world, and it was just terrific, big time. You know, it's much different than what some of the takes in the media are talking about, but, you know.
Yeah,
they were saying that
a lot of detractors that don't want him to succeed, and he's done a terrific job.
Oh yeah, and they were saying this is possibly one of the best speeches he's given to date.
Yeah, somebody equating it to a Ronald Reagan speech, you know, and you know, is that kind of a momentum maker for him? And I agree, he's turning the corner and you know, making it his presidency.
Yeah, maybe
it's a wonderful thing to see.
Maybe the liberals can now concede that he's not insane.
Yeah, it's funny that insanity seems to go in and out.
That is true.
It's a random insanity.
How are you folks doing out there with the fires and things?
We
I saw that it's up in your area too.
Yeah, it's kind of all around us.
Yeah, you had the dam problem. Now are you dealing with a fire as well?
Well, oddly,
we have a lot of dam problems.
We have a lot of dam problems, yeah. Good point. Good point, Bob. Oddly enough, I was supposed to go on a tour of the Oroville Dam repair and that kind of thing. I was supposed to do that tomorrow morning, and I was debating because it's well over 100 degrees, and I don't know.
Yeah, I heard it's up to 110.
Pretty common, but I was kind of debating on that. Got a text message a little bit ago that the fire is has enough evacuations going and there's enough chaos down there. It's close enough to the dam that they've canceled that. They don't want to add any more people to that mix. So, and then we have them up north of us as well, which is pretty standard. You know, sometimes it's lightning. You know, it's garden variety things you can't do a lot about. But you know, just our forest policy over a long time now is really come to a.
Yeah, it's coming home to roost.
It's really come to a head. We've got way too much fuel on the forests. I just wanted to let people know before we leave the idea of the speech in Poland, for those people that were working and, you know, only saw, like, itty-bitty news bites or whatever, we posted the whole speech, printed the entire speech. It's right on the website for today. So just says President Trump's speech in Poland. You can click on it and read the whole thing. And Melania's comments at the beginning are on there, too. Which is really nice. It's kind of fun to read it. I don't know. Maybe it's because I'm a reader, but I like reading the speech rather than listening to it sometimes because it's not you're not distracted by camera angles or people's I don't know. clapping.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I always like to brief myself before I see something live.
Yeah. You know, it says applause. I'm like, okay, I know what applause sounds like.
You know, I go and look at what everybody's saying, and I have my opinions, but then I'm watching what everybody's saying and saying, oh. So that's the way they're, you know, creating a narrative on this angle, and that's another angle on the narrative, and that's their angle, and this is what they want to take apart. So you see, you know, how they're deconstructing maybe a national security problem and not really addressing the issue itself. So that's how I look at it myself, you know.
I just think it's really helpful. So for the, you know, what I was actually thinking of doing was, I have a few people who have remained nameless, and I was actually thinking about just taking that printed speech and cutting out anything that said Donald Trump and just making it a printed document, you know, with no, no names, and sending it and saying, oh, wasn't this a great speech, from, you know, a few years ago, and just leave it at that. Just kind of see what response I got.
Drop out Donald Trump and insert Barack Obama.
Well, that's kind of where I was headed. I was going to hint around that it was Obama, but just take out all references to which president it was, and just for the fun of it.
So, yeah, we had a 4th of July here, and it was pretty good. It was, you know, the city did pretty well, but we also had the, you know, shootings and deaths. So, you know, that's still high.
Your classic Chicago holiday?
101 shootings, 15 deaths. You know,
wow. Just over the 4th of July?
Yeah, it was a longer weekend. You know, we had an extra day in there, so, yeah.
So you had time to kill more people. Gosh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, that's not good.
Oh, my gosh.
President Trump sent in ATF here, 20 agents, so they're supporting the police on the ground, state police. You know, it's a fully integrated network, and... you know, it'll probably take them a month or two to get a handle on it. They might need to double or triple the efforts, but, you know, it's hard. You know, it's isolated. There's gangs and there's cartels, and there's a lot of different mixes of those, as you know, in a bigger city like Chicago, and the criminal activity is just high, you know.
Do you have to just really pay attention to where you go, or is it kind of...
Yes, I mean, like any bigger city, yeah.
But, I mean, there are places you just don't go, I'm sure.
Yeah. New York, LA. You
know, yeah, sure. Like everywhere.
St. Louis.
Well, that's terrible.
DC.
So before we track down Marty, I should properly introduce our guest here, Bruce Moran. He's been on with us before. He brings us all sorts of good national security information. He is the National Security Advisor with the Security Solutions Technology Company, which is a veteran-owned company that provides federal government consulting, IT professional services, security assessments, and cybersecurity, geospatial, kind of a long list there. But Bruce focuses on strategic planning for national security issues. And so as a consultant, he works with public officials, U.S. government committees, departments, agencies, think tanks, and corporations. So he works on all sorts of stuff, and he's always shooting us a little thing like, hey, want to have so-and-so on? Let's talk about it. So I think most of us know little to nothing. I'm just going to throw down for most of us, we know little to nothing about the Assyrian Christians. And most people, I think, when they hear it on the news, think they're talking about Christians in Syria, the country. But it's really Assyrian, Assyrian. And so if we can find him, we have Martin Yomaran with the Assyrian American National Federation. He's going to come on and talk to us about that. You want us to take a quick break? Maybe you could call him?
Okay, sure.
All right.
Okay.
You give him a holler. We'll have a little celebration of capitalism here, and
okay,
then
very good.
And then call us right back.
All right.
All right. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We'll be right back.
Body and soul, then it's just your body, then they go. heard my mama cry. I heard her pray the night Chicago died. Brother, what a night the people saw. Brother, what a night the people saw. Yes, indeed.
Well, that's for you, Bruce.
Everything old is new again.
Okay, that's true. That was when singing about Chicago and stuff like that was kind of fun. But 101 people dying over 4th of July, slightly less fun.
Right now we're having the Taste of Chicago, so it's pretty crowded down here.
Oh, well, that's nice.
It's a five-day event where there are 40 restaurants positioned on the Columbus Drive here. And it's right off the lakefront. Beautiful day today. It's like 75, 80 degrees, and it's crowded.
Yeah, we wouldn't know anything about that.
Yeah.
it's 100 and who the heck knows what.
I think our low was about 80 today, last night.
I walked the dog this morning at 75. By the time I got home, it was 87, so it gives you some idea of what's going on. It was 7 o'clock. All righty, so we are joined by Martin Yomaran. And do you prefer to be called Marty or Martin?
Marty's fine.
All right, I wasn't sure on the whole Marty Martin thing. I know how that goes.
He has his own TV program, too. You see it, you know.
No kidding. Well, see, it's kind of funny for me because...
No, I was being facetious.
He can have a TV
talking
program.
Talking about the Ernest Borgnine movie.
He's going to be Marty Martin, you know.
We have some very serious stuff to talk about.
Of course
and,
we do. Always.
Marty's family's been involved in this for... basically their lifetime. It's their community, and it's a very sad and heart-wrenching situation that's been going on with the Assyrian community. So I'll leave it to Marty to start it off, and he can start giving you some details about what
thanks,
he's been
Bruce.
Doing.
Aaron and Bill, thank you for having us on to shed some light on the Assyrian Christian story. Obviously, since the fall of Saddam Hussein in Iraq, the Assyrian Christian population, pretty much estimates were over 2.5 million and now have dwindled less than 300,000 in Iraq. And, you know, it's been a, for the Assyrian Christians, it's been 100 years of continuous genocide since the Ottoman Empire, the fall of the Ottoman Empire from 1916 till now. You know, we saw over 750,000 Assyrians massacred then, and then continuous throughout the years. So, in 1933, the Sumela massacre in Iraq, where over 3,000 Assyrian men and women and children were massacred, we created the Assyrian American National Federation here in America, and it was to help the Assyrian community, just to pretty much organize and get the people assistance, humanitarian aid back home. And, to the new refugee Assyrians that were coming in to America, you know, because of the persecution back home, which is continuous to this day. And since the fall of Saddam, it's been worse and worse where we've been scattered all over the world. So what Bruce and I have been working on, and other Assyrians in the community, activism with regards to advocating for our own, internationally protected safe zone, or it would be the Nineveh Plain province where our, the capital of Assyria, Nineveh, was. If you recall what ISIS was destroying, the city of Nimrud, when they invaded, it's just been a continuous onslaught of invasions and Assyrians and other minorities being persecuted and being forced to flee their ancestral homeland. And that's what we're trying to do is help advocate and raise awareness about what we could do as Assyrians and then as Americans and just as humanitarians and how to stop, the genocide and stop the onslaught, per se.
Sure, because, I mean, my guess is that all of these people, they don't want to necessarily leave their own country. And then they don't want to necessarily move to someplace else, even though that would be a lot safer. But they just, it kind of sounds like, same old story. They'd like to just be left alone.
Yeah, can I interject something here? You're saying these people, those are Marty's uncles and aunts and other friends and family that are living in Assyria.
Right.
These are like American Italians. You're talking about their family living in Italy. If you're talking to me, you're talking about my family living in Ireland. So that's what you're talking to Marty about.
Right.
This isn't something that's otherworldly, and we're trying to, you know, save people from genocide. These are family members.
Right.
Yeah, this is family.
But as
Marty, can you tell them something about your ma serving over there and your cousin and stuff? I mean, this is American patriots right here who are serving, helping out the U.S. government serving over there.
After the fall of Saddam, when the U.S. went in, you know, obviously not everybody speaks Arabic or the native tongue, so they needed translators and people that they could trust with translation. So there was a hiring frenzy and hiring of translators. And my mom, you know, who's educated here in America, but obviously was born in Iraq, decided to join. And she's been a translator, linguist, since 2006. So for the past 11 years, she's been in Iraq and currently serving as a contractor for the Department of Defense, State at the U.S. Embassy in Iraq. In addition to that, my cousin, Edmund Octivo, who's the Midwest Regional Director, was a 20-year veteran of the United States Marine Corps, gunnery sergeant, retired. You know, he served five tours, three in Iraq and two in Afghanistan, and was also wounded in one of the battles. And so, you know, his heroics, you know, especially it hit close to home, because not only, you know, is he defending, fighting for the U.S., he's also, you know, trying to help his native ancestral, you know, homeland liberated from dictators and what. But now what we've seen is ever since the fall of Saddam, it's just been a continuous a vacuum. And you're seeing that when Aaron said, you know, our people just want to be left alone. Imagine if you're a 40-year-old and you're an engineer or a doctor, right? And then you're forced to flee and then come to another country where you don't really know the language. You're not going to get certified. What do you do? What do you do there, you know? And so that's why they're like, look, if you protect it, internationally protected area, and they did it with a no-fly zone, if you remember in the early 90s when Saddam attacked the northern part of Iraq, where he killed Assyrians and Kurdish people at that with the gas chemical attacks. They had a protected no-fly zone since the early 90s. So it is possible, especially today with today's technology, you know, they can have an internationally protected zone, just monitoring from the sky with drones and whatnot, and then having the local forces, local Assyrian and other minorities that are independent and not, you know, tied to any, you know, like political group or any side, just independent people taking care of their own cities and villages and towns.
And there's quite a few, we're looking at 3.2 million, so they could, you know, how many of them would support efforts back in their home territory? You know, some of them are in Kurdistan, of course, but you have them in, you know, you have, like, Marty's friends of friends, they're in Jordan, you know, they're in Turkey,
Lebanon.
I mean, they're in Iran,
and then,
so they want to go back home,
and... Right. Yeah.
You know, that's what they want to do, and that's their ancestral homeland. That's where they grew up. That has a lot of strong leanings towards, you know, because we're Christians and Catholics and Orthodox. That's where they're from. That goes back to, is that right, Marty? St. Thomas and St. Thaddeus? Am I forgetting somebody?
The start of Christianity, because, you know, when they say, who are Assyrians? Assyrians are, you know, we speak Aramaic, which is the language Jesus Christ spoke. And plus, you know, the history of where Joseph was from and everything. So it really hits home. It's, you know, they say the Garden of Eden and all those biblical places. I mean, it's significant to history, and especially what's been happening now is just really heart-wrenching, especially if you just heard, just with a finding against Hobby Lobby and what happened there with the antiquities, and there was Assyrian artifacts also included in the theft and whatnot. And this is, you know, imagine your history. Not only are you forcibly, but then your antiquities and your ruins are destroyed, and then everything is sold to the highest bidder, and then you're pretty much they're erasing your history,
right.
your rights to the land, and that's where we advocate and we try to push and get support, and last recognize that ISIS had committed genocide. After that, the administration fell short because nothing's been done since then. We're still trying to get that province protected. Nice. When ISIS invaded, now everything's being liberated. What's going to happen to the land? Is it going to be redeveloped? It's going to be reestablished. Security has to be the first thing, and then you have to develop it. The roads, the schools, jobs. It's really important. And after that, the resources that are there, and I think this is the reason why it's been hard for us to get back, is because there's a lot of oil and there's a lot of interest, outside interest for that land, specifically for that oil. And it's really tough because it's also our ancestral homeland and it's indigenous protected by, and should be. But that's where we're finding the difficulty, and hopefully we could do something to speed up the process with regards to support, because they've liberated Mosul. ISIS is pretty much done. Now the question becomes, what happens? What does the future look like for the Assyrians and other minorities that are left unprotected? Because when ISIS came in, we had no protection, not from the Iraqi army and not from the Kurdish Peshmerga who fled because ISIS came through. So, our goal is to try to make sure that we have our own police force and our own our own soldiers there protecting that land, because that's their homes. They're protecting, they're defending their parents, they're defending, protecting their families. Those are their homes, that's our land. If nobody has an affiliation to that land and no feel for it, they're not going to want to defend it.
Right.
They're just going to leave. That's not us. And that's what happened in Mosul, because they had Shia Muslims protecting Mosul, which is mostly Sunni. So when they came in, they just walked away. They didn't need to fight for it. That wasn't, But you go try to fight in Basra, in their homeland, in their stake, in their area, they would defend that more. And so
that makes sense. And, I guess my point in saying that was I can hear what usually happens is, oh, well, we just need to bring everyone here. I mean, that seems to always be the answer, is let's bring everyone here. And so my original point in saying that was that the people themselves who live there, who are undergoing all this, all this horrible disaster area, their goal isn't to get out of there. It's to make space there that is actually safe for them. And unfortunately, our colleges have kind of ruined that whole idea of safe space. We'll have to suspend all of our mocking for the purposes of this show. usually we're making fun of safe space, but gotta take a really, really quick break, fellas.
People, like I grew up in Chicago, in my area, we know where everything is at. I don't know if you remember, there was a horrific situation with Richard Speck killing 8 student nurses or Filipino nurses. Everybody in our neighborhood got up and started looking and combing the grounds, the prairies. We live by a lot of ocean-going ship areas where they have ports. Everybody was combing the ports. I mean, the whole neighborhood got up. You're talking about 25, 30,000 people start looking. That's what would happen in the Nivea Plain region, in these places where they can protect themselves with their own police, with their own military. They know where everything's at.
Sure.
They know where to look. You can't hide. See what I mean?
Hey, Bruce.
They know where all the nooks and crannies are.
Sure.
You put somebody else in there that's from Baghdad or maybe someplace in Kurdistan, they don't know what's going on. They don't know how to look around.
And they don't care. All right, fellas, we'll be back in just two minutes there. We've got to take a really quick break. We'll be right back.
Their land, their homes, their friends, their families, their neighborhoods. They'll go out and they'll come.
Okay. You're listening to We the People Radio. We'll be right back in 2 minutes.
World, it is exploding, violence flaring, bullets loading,
You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. We gotta get out of this place.
And we're back. Sorry about that unceremonious break previous. Whenever we have two people on the phone, it's always kind of hard for everybody to hear each other. So,
hey, Marty, I want to back up just a little bit. When we were talking about when Saddam was in power, the Assyrian community at that time was pretty heavily persecuted by him. When he left, when we got him out of there, you said it got worse. Why, what didn't we do to make it better at that time? And why did it go the way it went?
Well, one, it got worse for us because they see us as Western allies. They see us as Westernized, and they saw us, just like I told you when my mom and other linguists were working with the U.S. military, after the liberation, they actually also started targeting us, because in those, especially the hotbeds like Baghdad, in those areas where actually there's a heavy population of Assyrian Christians, they started blowing up the churches and started, because they saw us as a unprotected group, because again, we're not Shia, we're not Sunni, we're Christian, we share the same Christian values of the Western occupiers as they saw us. And there was no solution. They thought, you know, initially when they thought, you know, I remember they said they were greeting us with candy and when they were, we liberated them from Saddam. But what happened is there was no solution with regards to what happens after.
Right.
If you notice, maybe this is a comparable country, but when Hosni Mubarak for Egypt was out of power, and then Muslim Brotherhood came into power, and which was a complete opposite, or some, you know, the different group. It actually shifted Egypt's country into chaos and all that stuff, and they started going after different groups and whatnot. But when Al-Sisi came into power after, and you know, he was just it was a different person, but at least Egypt came back a little bit. Even though persecution of Coptics happened there. But at least they had a different plan, and they realized, you know, Iraq was a different animal, because once you got rid of Saddam, you got rid of the military, you got rid of everything. And the reason why Egypt was sustained was because the military stayed in power, was there. It was just that Mubarak was removed. In Iraq, I think if the military was you know, maybe something would have been different if they, because what happened is you pretty much got rid of everybody and everything, and then what do these people do for jobs? What do they do for their livelihood? What you pretty much uprooted and lifted, you just eliminated every part of the government. So I think what happened is there should have been a better plan of succession when Saddam was taken out of power. Somebody else could have stepped in, everything else could have remained in place, but it was just pretty much, you know, the bombing and the rebuilding that had to take place. You know, you start from scratch, and it's really hard, and especially shifting from the, and this is, again, you got to look at, you know, the, I'm not an Islamic expert or whatnot with the Shia Sunni, but if the Sunnis were majority of the government with Saddam, obviously, and the Shia were they didn't have anybody in government supporting them as much, and not everybody like that. So it was really like, you know, it was a change of the guard, but it was complete change, and that's not always good. I mean, we'd love to make every country like America, but you can't. You can't force our way of life on other countries. It
right.
just doesn't work.
No, it doesn't. So the area where your family comes from, how many different cultures are in that area. It's not just Assyrians. Who else lives there, and would there be continued struggle between the groups there?
There is already. You know, you see it with the Kurds. You see it with the Sunnis. So there's different groups there. Obviously, we're the ancestral people of that homeland. But I'm not going to claim, you know, the history of Assyria, because if I want to claim it, I can say all of Iraq is Assyria, right? It's our land. But let's be real with regards to what's happening now. And there are other groups, there are other people living there, and they've also called Iraq home for hundreds of years. So there are, like, the Shebek and the Yazidis. The Yazidis also faced the tremendous genocide in Sinjar and other areas. So they're also a group, and they are, you know, persecuted just like the Assyrians. But what's happened, the groups that are there, everybody's vying for positioning now. And this is the perfect segue with regards to what the KRG, the Kurdish Regional Government, is trying with regards to a referendum vote that's going to be happening later in September, and try to give the people a voice and possible, you know, because they're seeking independence for Kurdistan. I have a hard time saying Kurdistan, because that's ancestral Assyria, and it's northern Iraq, and Arbil is Arbilo, which is an old Assyrian city. But these areas are contested. They are, you know, for many, many years, Assyrians, Kurds, Arabs, all of them have been living peacefully together. And even though throughout history, you know, since the early 1900s, the Kurds, and Arabs and others persecuted Christians, but it has been relatively peaceful. Like in early 90s, when Saddam was in power, and he was against, you know, the Kurds in the north, the Assyrians and Kurds were fighting against Saddam, and they were actually, you know, living together in the north under the no-fly zone, and they sought some peaceful times and worked together and whatnot. So hopefully there could be some, you know, everybody works together, but what we're seeing is that the Nineveh Plain is now a piece of hot land that they're trying to annex into the KRG area, and they're disputing it, calling it a disputed area. We don't see it as disputed, because obviously that's our capital. We see it. Nineveh's right there. You know, the capital of Nineveh. So it's like, you know, we don't see it as disputed, but obviously because of the numbers, you know, the demographics have changed, but they forced our people to flee. Our people would not have left if it wasn't for the persecution, if it wasn't for, you know, they were forced out, as you saw in what happened with the ISIS invasion. That was it. They pretty much uprooted in Qarakosh, which is Baghdad. And Vice News had something about this. But when ISIS came in, 50,000 Assyrians fled that night, prior to ISIS coming in.
Wow.
50,000.
Yeah.
I want to do a referendum vote, but our people are not there. As Bruce said, we're scattered all over. So, and they're trying to force expatriates or Assyrians that are living in other countries not to have a voice. They're saying you can't vote if you're out of the country, because they want the people on the ground to vote. Well, if we don't have a voice and we're not being allowed to vote, how can we? You know,
right.
How can we have a true voice of where we want? And then they're saying, you know, well, the people on the ground can decide if they want to be a part of Kurdistan or remain part of Iraq. They can decide there. But, you know, it's like gerrymandering and what they do here in the state of Illinois to try to fix the districts for their benefit, you know?
Sure, sure. And it's difficult to have a voice and be in the country when, if you go back to the country, they come after you. So
exactly.
I understand.
Yeah, and if you don't have a safe zone to go for transitioning,
you're doomed.
You're a sitting duck.
Yeah, you can't go back.
And it doesn't make common sense unless you have a relatively safe region just to orientate. You need to orientate yourself to get your, focus back on where you're going to go, what you're going to do, and how you're going to do it. You got to find out what's going on in your town or village,
and who's there, who you know, and then you reestablish yourself.
Right.
It takes a while. If you're talking about a million or two people, and then if you want them to vote, and if they want it to be the Nivea Plain province, these people need to be there to talk about how they want their, you know, land to be secured and safe. So we have a law and order fabric built in to a safe zone that extends out, and where you have the local people who are Assyrians, Yazikis, and Sinjar in different regions protecting their own land, their own homes, their own businesses.
So how does that work?
Just to jump in.
How does that work with the 50,000 people that fled? I'm sure they owned land, they had homes, and they basically had to flee. What happened to their land and their homes? And is it being occupied now by somebody else who says it's theirs now because you left? Or how does that work?
No, ISIS destroyed it. ISIS destroyed pretty much everything. And it wasn't just ISIS. There was also reports of Peshmerga. Also, because obviously when they're clearing a what, they also destroyed. But nothing was saved, and they're just rebuilding everything. They've actually started to rebuild in a couple places, but they need support. Obviously, the financials, the support financially. I mean, you know, Senator Mark Kirk, who's now Tammy Duckworth took his place, Senator Duckworth, but... You know, Senator Mark Kirk, he was our congressman in the 10th prior to becoming a senator, helped start support for the minorities through appropriations. And even that money that was slated for our people, which is a continued resolution each year, wound up going in the wrong hands and not to our people. And say they had corruption, and corruption's big in every country, but sure. They especially there. It never made it to the minorities, the redevelopment, reestablishment. And then, you know, prior to ISIS, they had everything happening, so.
Mm. Oh, my gosh. We need to take one more quick break. I just wanted to let people know that I've added some maps, because that's the big piece of the puzzle we're leaving out on this whole thing. And Marty, you'll forgive us, as dopey Americans, we're not... we're just, you know, it keeps changing. We all learned about Persia and Mesopotamia when we were in school, and then all the countries changed names and they all moved around. It's really hard to figure out where everybody is these days. Maybe you could give us a little geography when we come back to help tie down some of these locations. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. That's probably a pretty big ask right now. So, Marty, can you give us some, give us a quick geography lesson, like of countries that we actually know now. Where was Assyria?
So Assyria made up, not with the invasions and whatnot, or back in the day where it grew, but historically Assyria is... Iraq, Iran, Turkey, and Syria. Parts of, so Syria derives from Assyria. The word Syria derives from Assyria. So that's how that came to be. But, it's obviously today you know them as Iraq, Iran, Syria, and Turkey, but that was Assyria. And so, our ancestors, there was different parts. There were some from the Urmia region of Iran, the Hakkari region, Hakkari Mountains of Turkey, and you had you had other areas like in Syria, where you see it now as Damascus. Damascus is the main capital, but where Qamishli and all those by the, you know, between the Tigris and the Euphrates, the rivers there, you had main Assyrian villages and towns and areas, so that were historic. And actually, if you just look at the history, what they're digging up now, I think in Syria, it was another Assyrian town that, you know, just the ruins. Whatever they're digging up from the ground is just coming up Assyrian right. ruins of the old empire back from the historical times.
Now,
that's what we're trying to state and claim that, like, look, throughout our history, this is what's been happening. This is, you know, we're the ancestral indigenous people of that land. We deserve to have a voice.
Right.
And yes, we're scattered all over the world, but that's not by choice. When people have a sword and they tell you to convert, pay tax, or die, it's like, what are your choices? And then do you want your kids and your daughters to live under Sharia law or other areas where Christians are looked at as a commodity, and their daughters are looked at as a piece of meat, and then they're, you know, and you don't want that. And, you know, we've lost so many to Arabization and Kurdification and many things like that, that it's just sad to talk about. But, you know, all we're trying to do is just protect ourselves.
Right,
you know,
areas
and people.
Where do the Yazidis come into this? Do they occupy the same area?
Yeah, so the Yazidis are also within that area in the northern part. They have some parts where Sinjar Mountain, the Sinjar region, and there's also villages and towns there, and they actually share a similar history to the Assyrians with the timeline. And so they're along those lines there, but again, it's, you know, the Nineveh Plain province that was approved in January 2014. In January 2014 in Iraq, that was to be a province, was for the minorities, which were the Assyrian, Yazidi, and Shebek, and Turkoman, you know. So it was for the minorities that were, you know, that did not have a area. So
now, were they all Christian?
No, they're not. They are not all, no. So the Yazidis have their own religion. Some are Muslim, some are, I'm not 100% with regards to their religion, but it's not Christian. It's something else related to, that's why they were seen as like, by ISIS and others as like, kind of like, witches and studying witchcraft. And so it wasn't really, you know, that's why they went to, you know, they slaughtered so many in Sinjar.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, it's not something to repeat, and you think in the 21st century that we're living in right now, that beheadings and massacres of that size would not be something, you know,
we might have moved on from that.
Yeah, you would think that beheadings are not happening and not occurring, but they do. And
so,
just,
what's your guess on, because obviously none of us are in control of this, but why is it that we don't hear particularly about the Assyrian people and the Assyrian situation?
Is it because
over here?
Is it because they're not on the ground there?
Because of what? Sorry, Bill?
Is it because they're not on the ground? Is it because they are spread out all over that they're not a factor in the dialogue?
You do have them there, and they are on the ground. It's just their voices, you know, when we were talking previous administrations, when we said we're Assyrian, you know, because we like to say more, that's our ethnicity, that's our identity, right?
Mm-hmm.
Our religion is Christianity. But when we kept saying Christianity, the previous administration said, well, we don't want to be seen as helping Christians against other religions, and that'd be seen, well, that's a Christian country helping their Christian brothers, and that's not what we want. We want to help
everybody. We don't want that.
And so it's a freedom of religious freedom, acts and everything with regards to what we were trying to do with Tom Lantos, commissions and others. They're just like, look, we're trying to raise awareness about what's happening. So we used pretty much from the media side, Iraqi Christians or Syrian Christians, or, you know, but that took away from our ethnic identity and our Syrian roots. And so maybe that it was messaging, but they kept saying to us, and these are people in media, in PR with regards to this, saying, look, the only way you're going to get the media attention is by saying Christians, Christians, Christians. But truthfully, the more we said it, the more we were persecuted for it, the more,
oh my gosh,
the more we were left aside. So really, other than
let me
okay, well, guys, we're out of the hour here, but
okay, let me talk on the other side.
Absolutely, when we come back,
I'll fill you in on what we've been doing for.
That's where I want to go.
It's been a longer time than
we just had to have
a year for us. We've been talking. Marty and I have been working on this for over 10 years.
Right on. All right, we'll be right back, fellas. You are listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Stay tuned for Hour 2 here at KCNR Shasta Redding.
Good afternoon. You are joining We the People Radio for our second hour here. We're talking about the Assyrian situation. How's that? With Martin Yomaran, who is the president of the Assyrian American National Federation. And actually, you can find them at aanf.org, Assyrian American National Federation. So aanf.org. Some good information there. And I think most of us really are pretty underinformed on this. Maybe it's just me. But and then joining us also is Bruce Moran, who is a National Security Advisor with Security Solutions Technology.
It's just you.
It's just me. Bill's all super smart about it. Mm.
Yeah, right.
All right, the quiz starts right now.
Okay.
Go ahead, Marty, drill him. No, kidding. All right, let's see. So we're going to go back to Bruce. Bruce is going to give us some info. We've in the first hour, if you missed that, you need it because we've been talking about geography.
Government, you know, off and on for the years, my team has, and one of the things we're looking at is the oil in that area, and that's one-third of the Iraq economy. And they're going to have to rebuild the oil pipeline. It's going to cost them about $10 billion to restructure through the refinery processes. But there are some reasons why people want the land, as you can see. If one-third of the Iraq economy is up in, you know, those regions where they didn't have control, now they'll be back online to support the regular Iraq government. And
are they actually drilling oil there, or is it just...
and the two the two biggest, you know, contracted groups are British Petroleum, okay,
mm-hmm.
You know, BC, and the other one is Luke Oil. So, you know,
also
there's other interests there, but as we're looking at what we're speaking about here, it's in the interest of the Iraq government, Baghdad, to make sure everything comes online again. Because that feeds, you know, Basra, Fallujah, Ramadi. They have to rebuild Fallujah. That was destroyed as much as the Nubia, you know, plain region. And Ramadi, you know, that was overcome, too, by ISIS. So there's a lot of things, you know, the Prime Minister Abadi needs to do. And he took it to ISIS. He destroyed them in Mosul. It was a large concerted effort of 8 months here. It wasn't an easy job. They booby-trapped the whole city. So, I mean, that's going door-to-door. And I don't know if you recall, about 6 weeks ago, we sent a missile there. And we got the ISIS people that were there, but they also booby-trapped the whole building, and they had civilians at the bottom of the building and adjacent. So we targeted right, but then when we targeted them, they blew up the entire structure, killing all the civilians. So that's what we had to deal with, and that's what Marty's talking about. And I want to take a step backward also and talk about the ability of the Syrians to fight. They fought alongside the British commandos during World War II. I think there were four companies that helped liberate Greece from the German Nazis. People aren't aware of that. They were in Greece. They were in Italy. These are heavily trained commandos that we're talking about that can help secure a safe zone. And these are their, you know, uncles, you know, and their grandfathers that were in these units. So what are we talking about? And
they also help, you know, in securing a lot of other areas. There's a great battle they had that they helped liberate. I hope I pronounce this right, Marty. This is in 1941, Habanaya, and that was largely due, you know, to the royal commandos of the British and the Assyrian fighters. We're not talking about, you know, people who can't defend themselves. We're talking about commandos. You arm them, give them heavy arms, give them some, you know, helicopters, attack helicopters. They'll protect the Nubia Plain region. They'll make sure the oil gets to the Iraq government.
Mm-hmm. Are we not arming them now still because they are afraid those arms?
Go forward where you want to go, Bob. At the time, I'm going back to 2013, 2014, when this all started to fester, when there was not enough protection, when the U.S. had pulled out in 2012. So there wasn't really a understanding of how bad it was on the ground, and the Assyrian Christians were raising the red flags all the time. They're shooting up fireworks saying, help us, give us some aid,
right.
Let us, you know, support the efforts here. And all of a sudden, ISIS appears, and they run right through the area and destroy everything and everybody. And historically, that's the Aramaic teachings that Jesus taught, you know. And if Marty can help on that later, the Archbishop had secured those documents in the Vatican. That's how bad it got, because he knew we might lose the original teachings of the apostles.
Mm-hmm.
So those kind of things historically are relevant, but we're talking about people, real people, ordinary people on the ground who got uprooted and became destitute, or they ended up out of the country as refugees, and they wanted to come back. And from my understanding, when we first started working on this, there were about 25,000 of the Assyrians who wanted to take up arms. And how many are there now, Marty? 1,000 that are in the company that is fighting in the region? Or?
Yeah, 1,000 ready with another 1,000 ready to go. It's just they're being blocked, vetoed by the other partners there, by the KRG, pretty much, because they don't want to fall under the command of the Peshmerga. So because they want to remain independent, not fall under the command of the Peshmerga, they're not being supported. So they're vetoing their power. So we're trying to help the U.S. Coalition, the U.S. forces and allies, trying to help get them approved. And they finally got us a base. We trained 1,000. The U.S. Special Forces also trained us. Navy SEAL Charles Keating, may he rest in peace, was there when he was when he died. He was there, a part of a force that was helping get them out of the area where ISIS was attacking, and they needed an exit. And so he was a part of the Quick Reactionary Force, QRF force, that helped get them out. But they were there training the Assyrians. And so they trained, they fought, they were, you know, given tests by the U.S. government, military, to see how they clear a village, what they do. They actually passed, they did well. They started getting some support, but again, not the support that's needed to sustain or something to build on. And then, you know, the approval of the additional forces. Like Bruce said, you know, prior to ISIS, we tried to get a police force of 5,000, which we only had 770 go live, with the others being blocked by the KRG government, again, because what they want to do is pretty much have us go under that control, so that there's no need for another force, other than if they're Peshmerga or Iraqi forces, then they're, you know. But hopefully the NPU, which is one of the main independent force there, that has the support of the masses, that has the support of the soldiers and the people, that they are trying to establish themselves, and with the support of the USG, the U.S. government and other allies, to help support them. And, you know, they've done well. They've done well. But, again, they need sustained support. And everybody asks for the support of the U.S. Same thing with Peshmerga and others, where they wanted weapons to help fight ISIS and everything like that. You really want to make a difference. You know, you really got to support them. And then we don't want U.S. troops on the ground. It's our, you know, they're looking at it like, look, it's our country. We can defend it. We can protect it. Just let us, because You know, and then they're like, well, why is it all, some people would say, well, why should we do that? Well, it's, unfortunately, it was the U.S. that actually invaded and took over and got Saddam out. So it became our problem, like it or not, you know?
Why don't they want to fight under the Peshmerga?
That was my question, too.
So the Peshmerga, one of the main reasons is because of the support of the people during ISIS. When ISIS invaded, they left Assyrians without protection. When they said, here's what they did. Prior to 2 weeks, and this is proven, and there's documents. So they went around with leaflets and saying, we're coming around taking weapons away because we don't want to have any factions or anybody having any, any militias rising or anything like that. You guys shouldn't have any weapons like that. So they went around in an airplanes and took weapons 2 weeks prior to ISIS invading. ISIS invaded, and prior to that, they said, you don't need the weapons. We have protection. We're going to protect you. We're going to be the last ones to go, and if anything happens, you know, we'll defend you regardless. You know, see what I'm saying? So what happened was, as soon as ISIS came, they fled and left Assyrians and Yazidis unprotected.
With no weapons.
No trust. Right. That's why. There's no trust.
And in addition to that, that makes sense.
That's the untold story.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So
right.
That's one of the main reasons. The other one is that, now, you know, prior to the fall of Saddam, they were all in the same area defending and fighting together and protecting. So their whole thing is like, you know, they can defend and protect themselves and have the same level of autonomy to administer their own interests, self-administered government, self-administered area for their own areas. And people would trust your own people protecting you versus someone else. And of course we can be partners and work together in that community in those areas to, you know, because we have a common enemy that's ISIS, and everybody wants to protect their homeland. And you know, it's one of those like lesser of three evils. The KRG area, and they've lived with Assyrians for many years, peaceful, some not peaceful. But again, why they don't want to be under the command of the Peshmerga is that they want to have their own. They feel that they would also lose their sense of
identity, yeah.
Indigenous sense of rights, because they're already being treated as third class citizens.
Sure.
If you, what happens is any U.S. company or any company that comes in there that wants to hire a company that comes in there. That wants to hire, what happens is they're supposed to hire from everywhere. They rarely hire Assyrians. They're not getting any support. The only way you get support is by if you're a part of the KDP party, the government party there, and supporting the government initiatives. If you are, then they take care of you. If you're not, then they don't. They take care of our churches. Our churches are fairly safe in the northern part. And peaceful compared to other places where there have been bombings in Baghdad and in the Dora neighborhood and others where, you know, Sayyid Najat, which was a Catholic church, which was over 70 Assyrians were massacred, Assyrian Catholics of the Chaldean church.
Again.
They were massacred. And it's just horrific stuff that happens. But again, the thing is, with our political parties that are there, our people there in government, they have the capability, the intellect to run their own affairs. And that's what they want. They want the same level of treatment as everybody. Equal rights, equal opportunities for all. Just like we have here in the U.S., hopefully we have it there. But what we're seeing is the occupied becomes the occupier. And, I mean, not all are bad, obviously. But, again, they feel that, you know, the Nineveh Plain is our last stronghold area where we can say that, hey, we can have this as a province and administer our own self-administered area with our schools and with everything like that. So, and that's the other issue is with the jobs, training, and the schooling.
Schooling
in northern Iraq is if they teach, they only let you teach Assyrian in one class. If you teach the whole curriculum in Assyrian, which is Aramaic, which we teach, if you teach it, the funding gets limited.
Right.
They don't support. But even though the Assyrian schools, if we have them, they go and they teach Kurdish. So they teach all the classes in Kurdish, Assyrian, and Arabic, so and English. So there's that four languages are being taught in the school.
What a mess!
And the testing has to be done
sure.
in those to be accepted.
No, we have a lot of questions. All right, we have to take a quick break and celebrate a little capitalism here for 2 minutes, and then we'll be right back.
Yeah, capitalism is good.
We'll be right back with our guests, Marty
and
Bruce.
Lives.
Exactly. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Point. Nobody wants to live like a refugee. It's a pain. Hey, Marty. Okay, we have kind of a general question here. If kids were in school, and it's hard to say none of this had happened because I know everybody in that region moves around a lot. But would those be languages that people would know anyway? I mean, are those languages kind of like Spanish and Portuguese? I mean, they're really similar, so you might know both.
Spanish and Italian. I mean, do they kind of sound the same?
In that area, yes. And so Arabic is primarily mainly what's spoken. But actually, in the north, they push more Kurdish because obviously their goal is independent Kurdistan, so that's going to be language of the land. But and they also actually even Kurds or all Arabs know Assyrian. And they speak it, and they can, you know. So they all understand, and you know, the words of those areas. And you have to, just because most of the shop owners, you know, speak either Kurdish in the northern part, and then so a lot of the Assyrians that actually fled north because it was safer than other areas in Iraq needed to speak, you know, to communicate with people and whatnot. So you know, there's. You need to understand all the languages, so they do. So
I would say Turkish also, because there's a lot of travelers going back and forth from Turkey that are Kurds.
And geographically, how big of an area are we talking about where these four languages are all spoken? Is it like the size of Texas? Is the like the size of the United States? I mean, how big geographically are we looking at here?
I would say it's Texas, California, or you would say California, Oregon.
Okay, so it's fairly large area.
Combining the areas, like you know, where parts of Syria, Turkey, those areas. Obviously, Bruce alluded to it. You know, there are some Kurds in Iran. There's Kurds, and so that language is predominantly spoken. Same thing with Arabic. Obviously, Arabic, it's the whole, you know, the Middle East, they speak it. They're actually speaking a lot of English, which is good, because of the U.S. companies and other companies that are coming in and whatnot, and so they're learning English, too, so that's big. And Assyrian, so that's what we promote. We have schools that are run by the Assyrian Aid Society, which is a non-for-profit, and that runs the schools in northern Iraq, and some of their funding, most of the funding that's supposed to come from the government, actually, because of what's been happening with the government resources in the north, but also because of, like we said, because they're not fully integrated with the KRG schooling system and their curriculum, but although it is in line with it, and they speak in all the classes are taught in Aramaic, in addition to the other languages being taught, their funding doesn't get there in time or doesn't get there throughout, so they're limited with resources, and that's when charities and people donate through the Syrian Aid Society and help get them support.
Interesting.
What's really sad for an Assyrian child in that area is for the past several years, a lot of them have been have not been going to school, or have been going to school in horrible conditions, or they've been going just period, like in a few months here and there, because safety is an issue. Getting them to and from school is an issue, because some of these schools are actually in remote villages that have impassable roads, and they're not paved roads or anything. Oh. So it's really like going through a rural area, and in a mountainous region, and valley. So it's really, really tough to get to and from school. And then in addition to that, a lot of them are in the refugee situation, where they're going, you know, going to Syria because it was safer at one point to go to Syria instead of staying in Iraq. Then Syria became a hotbed and became Iraq 2.0. Then they fled, Assyrians fled Syria and tried to get back to Iraq or other areas, and or Jordan or Lebanon, and stayed there until it was safer to come back. You know, now it is. So what happens to those kids? And
yeah,
imagine those kids that become refugees. So for the past 11 years, since the fall of Saddam, so what are we, 14 years in, since 2003, imagine if you're a 14-year-old kid living there. So for the past 14 years, so you figure 9 years of that you should be in school, you've been all over in camps. And they try to get schooling in the camps, the refugee camps, but it's really hard to do. And you know, if you're a kid that was under ISIS control of this area, or you were, you know, going from camp to camp because, and then people flee the camp because of Muslim extremists that are running the camps. It's not safe for Christians in those camps. So even that, and then you have to keep moving. And then when you're there, it's like these kids have trauma, mental issues that, you know, that have not been, diagnosed, and others because they've seen so many horrific things.
Oh yeah.
And so imagine if you're a student, and this is what you see. What would you do? Like, how do you just, school is, that's why school is not in their, you know, they just want to learn. They want to, but it's tough. And then mm-hmm. when they are, it's just, they're so far behind, because if they come to America, they're 14, 15 years old, they might have a fifth, you know, they should be in like fifth grade education wise, but because of their age, they're put in freshman year of high school.
Right.
They don't know anything. So they just wait until it's time and they just drop out and they're stuck. That's why it's important to make sure that they have a place in their homeland.
Yes.
So they can preserve and protect it, you know, to stay there and thrive. And, you know, if they have the opportunity, they've shown that they could, you know, they have some of the highest grades, along the Iraqi school system. Even some of these people that have been in these horrific areas, and because it's just, you know, they're smart, so we need to give them the opportunities, and it's, you know, they do learn all these languages. It's surprising, but they do. They learn all the languages, and it's amazing. If anybody's gone to northern Iraq, and you can see these schools, and it's amazing what these kids have been through, but, you know, they're just, you know, hopefully we can get the situation resolved and get you know, stability there.
Yeah, you think about the kids in our country that struggle with their own language or learning one other language, and here these kids are you know, it's a matter of survival.
Trust me, I used to be an English teacher. They're struggling with their own language.
Yeah,
there's a lot of that.
Yes,
tell us this too. Now with the Kurdistan Regional Government, that's the KRG that you've been referencing. And I realize this is a broad generalization, but are they basically good guys? I mean, how do the Assyrians view them?
You know,
obviously compared to ISIS.
We're not saying Kurdish people are bad. We're not saying, but obviously the government, the KRG government, are not the good guys here.
Yeah, okay.
They are not. Their job and their goal, regardless of what they show or sell the Western world. And you know, the Peshmerga, they're fighters, yeah. And that's why we created our own, you know, tried to get the Assyrians to create their stand up for their own land, because they said, look, we spill blood for our land, we fight for our land, which they do. Peshmerga is a formidable, force. And they're ready to fight for Kurdistan, but so are Assyrians. They're ready to fight for their independent, land, and you know, they just want to be treated as equals. That's all they are. But unfortunately, the KRG government, suppresses, even with votes, and when we were trying to do a democratic process, for voting and everything like that, they were suppressing votes, they weren't giving fair elections, they were limiting, and what they did was to divide and conquer. They created, they created Assyrian groups, you know, and political groups funded by the KRG government to pretty much be the voice of the people on the ground, just to give additional party support that were supportive of the KRG initiatives,
right,
policies. So you could say stooges or whatnot. And these were people within our community. These are people, you know, and it's such a it's a play in politics, and I get it. You know, if there's a government, they're trying to expand their space, their area. They're trying to get an independent Kurdistan. They want to be free. You know, they were building churches. The funny thing is, Aaron, you know, Bill, Bruce, if you went to Iraq in 2006, 2007, actually, I was there in 2012. I saw a $2 million church with a neighborhood that was in disarray, with had no paved roads, no paved, no houses like that. You could say, okay, these are livable houses. People can, nothing, no job creation or companies, nothing. And you would think, well, how are people supposed to?
Yeah.
You know, but they built a $2 million church. That was because the KRG government wanted to show the world that they're welcoming of Christians. And they used the money to build a $2 million church. Yet the people of those villages and towns, they said, we don't want this church. We have our own old church. And they used that instead, even though they built this monster.
Well, you can't eat a church, and you can't, you know, it doesn't keep you warm at night.
Well, like you said, it's the politics.
Exactly. And it was just a facade. And it was just a show that, you know, and they got I give them credit. They're advocating hard. You know, they have a great lobbying effort happening in D.C. They are the lesser of three evils, because in the northern part, in Erbil and all those areas, they're safe. They're safer than other areas. But have situations occurred? Yes. Have Assyrians been treated unfairly? Absolutely. There's been land grab, land theft, continuous, and you don't get a fair shake in court. They blocked, at one point, where there was in an area called Nala in the valley, an Assyrian Assyrian village, a Kurdish person who was tied to the Barzani family, which is a prime minister of the KRG president. He was a chieftain who was his cousin or something. Built a house on Assyrian land in that village, which was all Assyrian. And when they tried to take it away from him, and you know, they said, no, we have property, these are our rights, there's a title, everything, he still built. They beat up the owner of that land. Then when did a call for a protest in Erbil, in the capital, they blocked, the Peshmerga blocked any Assyrians from leaving and coming into that village, in that town. They blocked them. They didn't allow them to go through. And then at every checkpoint going into Erbil, they did not let Assyrian Christians through until a period of time when the protest was done.
Wow.
So this, so it's not your Western free democratic it's not. And then we've had other stories where, you know, if you speak out, you know, it's not safe. It's not great. But, I mean, we're here in America. We have a right to. We could be the voice of our people that are suppressed, that cannot speak. And that's why we're saying to this day, yes, you know, we want to be partners with everybody, but it doesn't mean that they step on our throat to get to where they're going want to go.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
We need to have our own equal rights as every you could say Iraqi, because it's Kurdistan region, or so-called, is what they call Kurdistan here, is still a part of Iraq. So they should all be treated equally. And especially somebody like the minorities that are not being treated with any rights, because they're saying, well, they're a minority number. They're not a majority. The majority are the Shia, Sunni, and the Kurds. Yes, but we had, like I said, over 2 million Assyrian Christians prior to 2003 that are now all over the place, but it doesn't mean that we don't have a voice.
Yeah, and if the politics of that region stay like they've been forever and a day, if you sided with them or threw in with them in some way, then when the common enemy is gone, you wind up being under their thumb.
Exactly, and that's what happened when the fall of Saddam. That's what happened. When he fell...
So here's what we're talking about. It's the reconciliation and stabilization efforts that failed over in Iraq, in northern Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And that came under the guise of the Coalition Provisional Authority. And taking a look at what was left as a vacuum up in Iraq in these particular areas for these people. And I don't want to call them these people, but they're the ordinary people on the ground who are minorities that have rights and religious customs that are being overshadowed by a larger political force that is not taking into consideration what we came in there to do as a Coalition Provisional Authority. So I think if you look at what a body, the Prime Minister, is advocating, maybe he is moving in that direction. But this is what President Trump would have to advocate and come to a reasonable way of understanding what stabilization and reconciliation efforts really are there, and probably go to the UN Security Council and look at that and how they want to draw up a resolution to make sure people are protected, people are honored and respected for their culture. I'm sure those are thoughts that have, you know, passed through the central government of Iraq, but the overriding political schemes are, you know, being overshadowed by what can be done for the average person on the ground. And if you're looking at how we're going to address this issue, it must be addressed pretty much straightforward and upfront that there was the genocide going down on the ground, and it wasn't addressed politically correct by the UN Security Council. Nothing was done to intervene, and no safe zone was set up at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So where does the responsibility lie?
Yeah.
I think that's a very strong argument here.
Yeah, we created a huge vacuum.
Why did everybody turn their eyes away at these points?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've created this vacuum and didn't stick around long enough to see that it was filled in properly. We kind of turned our back on it and let it run its course, and this is what we ended up with.
Hmm. Well, fellas, let's take one more quick break here, and then we'll come back and run you to the top of the hour.
I wanted to get a little stronger about responsibilities that were taken into account at those times. And, you know, those are really serious issues when you're dealing with genocide. So,
okay.
Yeah, and I'd like to know, you know, we always like to tell our listeners what they can do. So if you have anything that people can do, any way that they can weigh in meaningfully, just, you know, besides, you know, just being...
And Marty can help...
that would be useful.
...the tone on this, because we're, you know, positioning this for our government to have a foreign policy where... This is not only going to be happening just in Iraq, but there has to be some semblance of mind, some reasonable facsimile thereof, that these things are happening all around the world. And they need to be addressed in this way.
Sure.
Sure. We can't just pluck everybody out of their homeland and park them here. I mean,
That's right. And then we have the refugee situation that the president is correctly addressing right now. I mean, you have a whole... See, if this didn't take place in Iraq and Syria in the first place... With all the refugees, then you wouldn't have the problem in Europe. Then the president wouldn't have had to write an executive order to address it.
But it goes
back to the fundamental principle of what happened with the basic reconciliation and stabilization efforts in the first place after the fall of Saddam Hussein. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Well, you know, if we didn't have something to fight about, we wouldn't be happy. So I don't know.
All right.
Good grief. We'll be right back, though.
Let Marty take the ending. Okay.
All right. We have posted a bunch of good information for you here at WeThePeopleRadio.us. Be right back.
People living their lives for you on TV. They say they're better than you, and you agree. He says, hold my calls from behind those cold brick walls. Says, come here, boy. There ain't nothing for free. Another doctor's bill, a lawyer's bill, another cute cheap thrill. You know you love him if you put him in your will, but... Save yourself.
the wheel.
Guess that's one way to solve the problem.
Take the wheel.
All right, so we were talking during the break, and oh, apparently someone else was too. There's just been so much going on in that area. Marty, how do you ever untangle who really belongs to what piece of land at this point? Is there any hope of that even happening?
Well, if you just dig up, excuse me, the noise. Sorry, I'm out in Chicago here. But if you just dig up what's coming up, everything's coming up Assyrian. We have our roots. We have our antiquities that tie us to our land, and we're still there for 7,000 years, pretty much 6,767 years to be exact. But so we've had the roots, and that's what ties us to our land. It's our ancestral roots and our antiquities that are still there. Everything they're digging up, their ancient city. That's what ties us. Others have been, they've come in for the years, like the last couple hundred years. But our people have been there. And you can see to historical facts of who's tied to that land. So that is the key, but when we posed this question to the KRG government, they said, look, they said, we are on this land now. Assyrians are under the land. We are on the land. Where are the Assyrians? Yeah, a lot of us, through persecution, have fled, and it's been tough, but our people are still there and have roots there. So it's important that we, keep that in mind. And that's why we keep fighting for it. And we're not going to give up because, we have Assyrians that are resilient. And, they'll say, till the day I die, I'm never going to leave that land. So they're going to have to kill me to get me out of there. So what we want to do is we want to be their voice. For the people that want to stay, the people want to be there.
Now, if all the Assyrians basically say they, magically came up with a solution to this thing, and the Assyrians all return to their homeland, what are the numbers there? How many are there worldwide that could come back and occupy that land?
So that's a good question, Bill, because obviously throughout the years there's been, it's a melting pot throughout the world. But the numbers prior to the fall of Saddam, as you said, over 2.5 million roughly in Iraq, another about 3 million in Syria, you would say. So roughly over 5 in those areas. But in Iraq itself, you would have, throughout the world there's, I would say easily scattered all over. The numbers would be definitely in the high, I would say about 10 million overall, you would say. But again, that is taken into account all of the Assyrians with all of the denominations of their religious. Some identify as Chaldean Christians, some identify as Syriac, Orthodox, Aramaean, some of the Maronite church, just so many ties to the different churches. But just for the ones that are exactly within Iraq, you would have easily that if we just get back to the pre Saddam, was the fall of Saddam would be 3 million to 5 million would be a good number. And if you really had in Assyria, I think you would have more people come through. But our goal is to get that, and we don't know if that's gonna.
Right.
And it only works if we have a safe zone for transition.
Yeah,
an implemented tool that can come from the UN Security Council and be backed by the United Nations and make sure that the Iraqi government, understands, what they need to do with themselves because they understand the situation on the ground and they've been discriminated against themselves. So the Shiite, they themselves were under the thumb, and they had several, setbacks themselves. So they themselves, as Shiite, want to be properly recognized. And then you have the Sunnis, who want to be recognized. But if you look at what's going on in Nivea Plain region, and that becomes autonomous, then that can hold its own and protect the entire country because, like I was saying earlier, one-third of the oil reserves for the entire country comes from that region.
Right.
If it's an equal play with everybody's interest, then everybody will have an interest in keeping it alive. For, and that means all the people of Iraq, going all the way down to Basra, over to the west, you know, Baghdad, mm-hmm. to Fallujah, Ramadi. Those need to be rebuilt. And the Shia, you know, and the Iraq military, they need to be supported. You know, in the first battle of Fallujah, the morgues were filled, you know, in Baghdad. The widows were crying because the ISIS came through. I was in communication with them at the time. It was horrific. So everybody has a stake in this.
Right.
And I think having the autonomous region there and a province is the right way to go.
Well, it makes
that's
a lot more
sense.
The argument
for this, because it's a neutral, it'll be like a Switzerland area.
Yeah,
and
there
everybody
you go.
Has the right to, you know, the freedom of speech, the right to their cultural identity. And those are the important critical factors for any country to survive.
Well, it's better than boxing everybody up and sending them to someplace else. You know, that they where they don't...
Well, they'd never fit in.
Yeah, they don't know anything about the culture. They didn't particularly want to live there. Now they're kind of stuck there.
So the Syrians want to live where the Syrians are from.
Exactly.
Syrians
right.
from Syria want to live in Syria.
Right.
You know, and, you know, you have 14 different groups battling back and forth. You know, there's mercenaries and all kinds of different groups in Syria fighting against each other. You have Khorasan, you know, those are the Al-Qaeda groups, and they want to establish their own caliphate state. And, you know, there's a lot of different interests coming to play. But if you set up, like I say, just in Iraq, I'm stepping aside from Syria. I'm not saying setting up a safe zone in Syria. I'm saying set it up in Iraq where the people who live there can control the land, and they know what to do. And these people that are criminals, that are jihadists, that are from ISIS, ISIL remnants, they'll be able to, you know, root these people out right away because they know
sure.
their land. They know like the backside of their hand.
Yeah, they know who belongs
no
and who doesn't belong.
You know, they can do what General Mattis says: annihilate them,
yeah.
get them out of there,
and
just
and they're
and
actually
get the
doing
oil
that
back.
Now.
And then that's one third of the country's
that.
Oil production to help the entire, you know, country get that back online. Like I said, it's about $10 billion to restore that pipeline, but, you know, get it going. Get the people economically back on their feet. That's about stabilization. That's reconciliation efforts. Get it going.
Well, Marty, how can people support your effort?
They can do it a couple of ways, Aaron. Sorry about the background. We're at a Syrian restaurant, so it's good music up. But
what? We're in a room with
but
no
the food's
food.
Good.
We're in a room with no food. What the heck?
Yeah. So the way they can help is they can go on our website, www.anf.org. We are a non-for-profit 501c3. We have a few of our partners, which are the Assyrian Aid Society of America, which is an NGO. We have the Nineveh Plains Defense Fund, which is we tried to set it up like the Israeli Defense Fund, Defense Forces Fund.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's NPDF, the Nineveh Plains Defense Fund, .com. Those are ways that they can help. But the main part is, you know, advocacy and support online for support of the Assyrian Christians. Just speaking to your congressman, asking them what they are doing, how are they helping the indigenous, the Assyrian Christians, how to return back to their homeland. We're really anxious and supportive of the new administration. Hopefully they can do something to support. You know, President Trump really pushed hard for this and stomped at, you know, to defend the Christians being beheaded in the Middle East and how that was horrible. Now we're just calling on that administration to really see us as an ally, because we can be a buffer between the different groups there, because we share the same religion views, and we're Westernized. We're it could be a great way to be an ally to Israel and to the U.S. and for their interests. And we said it: if they want to build a base, they want to set up refineries and help, you know, establish U.S. companies there, we'll be happy to support and work, because we've done that in the past with the British, and our people are ready to do it again. So,
good.
If any, just more help, which would be greatly appreciated.
Well, I think knowing more about the situation would help everybody, because you guys, I think, really from a media standpoint, very much take a back seat, which is extremely unfortunate. But we don't hear enough about the situation of the Assyrians. And I think when people hear that, they think that they're saying Syrian Christians. I don't think a lot of people are familiar with the term Assyrian out there. If you haven't done much world history, just
right.
And it's confusing.
That's the thing. We're always identifying who Assyrians are and there's still Assyrians around. Bill O'Reilly famously once said, there's Assyrians? They're still around? Yeah. Yes,
well, I guess I rest my case there.
We're still around. Yeah. So I'm with you, Aaron. It's more information, just knowledge out there and sharing. And I thank Bruce for all his efforts. And I thank you for giving us the opportunity, you and Bill, to present this. And hopefully we can do a lot more. Again, for more information, if they want to reach out to us independently, ask for more information, we could. Our information is on our website. Again, that's www.anf.org.
Cool. Well, Marty, keep in touch with us. If things on the ground change over there, let us know. We'll have you back on. Bruce, thank you very much for the contact here. It's been an
eye-opener. We're always meeting interesting people from Bruce. Bruce lives in an interesting world.
Yes, he does.
If by interesting world, you mean Chicago.
Yeah, he's in a dangerous world in Chicago there. So Bruce, you want to end this up for us?
Thank you for having us on. God bless you. God bless America. God bless our troops everywhere around the world serving our intelligence community. And thank you for having us on.
Absolutely. And you
know
what?
God bless everybody.
Thanks a lot to Marty. Thank your parents, or your mom and your cousin and stuff. That's awesome that they're playing such an important role. And again, those are things that people just don't know.
Yeah, thank you, Aaron. They're still fighting fight, so we're going to keep doing that. And we thank you for the opportunity again.
Absolutely, we really appreciate it. So sure. Bruce, what's the next step for you guys? Are you?
We're working on working with Rex Tillerson and talking to people at the State Department, and we're moving over there in a week or two. So.
I bet that's a lot easier than dealing with the past administration, huh?
We'll just make that assumption for you. How's that? Since it's probably politically incorrect for you to confirm or deny.
We're laying the foundation for the safe zone right now.
Good.
And there's a lot of operations that need to be done to help the Iraqi government. We're just not talking about in the Nineveh Plain region, but in the entire country, to help them upgrade what they need to have in terms of NGO networking and a lot of technology and wherewithal for working with the, joint military civilian operations for Iraq itself. Like I said, they need to rebuild Fallujah, Ramadi. It's just not a simple one, horse pony show here. It's for the entire Iraq government to come on board and do, they have to take this under their belt because it has to be their own initiative, but
sure.
We can provide them with some, technologies and things that really get things going for them and, help them in the long run to establish themselves as a nation. And I think that's what the government of Iraq wants to do.
Sure.
We're providing them with a foundation for stabilization and reconciliation efforts that will help sustain them in that way, and then they run with the ball. I don't expect to be there. If I go there, I don't expect to be there a long time. I know they know what to do. It's their own country.
Sure.
And they know the people.
We just need
like
to carve them out a little niche.
The people that live up there, they know their land like the back of their hand, and they can deliver on that.
That's awesome.
So thank you,
Bruce.
It
has to be across the board in Iraq because it's all new to them, being a nation, and they have all these different political groups that were, suppressed. The Shiite were heavily suppressed, so they're trying to, come to terms with what they need to do and
exactly.
be recognized. And then the Sunnis are now on the lower end of the spectrum. So, And that has to be understood, too. So, and then we have, you know, what we're talking about now with the safe zone with the, you know, minorities.
We've got to jump off
so
here.
These are all things that
cutting into the news.
United Nations,
you can't hear me again.
Security Council can help draw some, you know, resolution about and make it a real deal for the Iraqi government to be recognized.
Bruce!
Right. Bruce, you can't hear us. Oh, we've got to jump off. We're cutting into the news.
Thanks, Aaron.
Thank you so much. Bye, you guys. Have a great Sunday.
Bye. Okay, you too.
You can find all the information about our guests and the topic and the commercial-free archive later on at WeThePeopleRadio.us.